Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears back with you here Wednesday, March the 2nd, 2022, 3-2-22, 14 and a half minutes past the hour, and we have got a guest this hour who I like a whole lot. I cannot believe the world of politics must not have been as volatile as it once was, because we have not had our guest on in quite some time, and that is certainly not because we have not wanted to have her on, because I love when she's on. She's been a regular on this show over the years, helping us kind of piece together what's going on in the world. You probably remember her best as a long-running panelist on the McLaughlin Group. What a great series that was. She currently writes for the Daily Beast and appears on many, many news programs all throughout the world to help us sort out the State of the Union last night with President Biden and everything going on with Russia and the Ukraine. It's great to welcome back to these microphones for the first time in quite a while, Eleanor Cliff. Eleanor, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I've been hunkered down like the rest of the country throughout the pandemic, but things are definitely opening up, and I thought the speech last night on the theme of unity, the country does seem to be united in the war to preserve democracy and to stand on the side of Ukraine. And I thought the president did a good job outlining multiple issues that are facing his presidency and indeed the country, and putting us on some solid footing at least for a day or two as we reflect on his words.
You know, Eleanor, before we get into the speech, something that struck me this morning, first of all, the State of the Unions normally happen in late January. This was pushed off because of the pandemic. It was President Biden's first State of the Union. And it happens during this Ukraine-Russia thing. So it's not really front and center this morning on a lot of the newspapers across the country. Is that just to be expected with what's going on in the world?
I guess so. I mean, I was struck by that as well. I mean, the Washington Post, which I get in the print version, does have stories below the fold, no picture. And the New York Times does not even reference, well, no, I take that back. There is a column on Biden pitches plans for economy and the virus. But the headline is Russia batters key cities in wider attack, and then Biden seeks to rally world against Putin. It's Biden and Putin that are dominating things, and all of the expanse of the speech, and it covered so much territory. Before, people were wondering how the speech writers were going to put together a speech that addressed all the crises and didn't make it sound like it was, you know, six or eight speeches stitched together. They did a great job under the banner headline of unity. And this is the first time I've seen serious unity expressed in the House chamber for some time. It was mainly on Ukraine, but on other issues as well. So I think it is to be expected that it didn't dominate the front pages, considering the world is facing with this standoff with Putin.
You know, it was interesting, Eleanor. I watched the speech last night on NBC Network, and the first critique when it was over was from Chuck Todd, host of Meet the Press, was that, and he spent a lot of time on this, that Biden did not spend enough time talking about Ukraine. I think it was only 12 minutes off the top.
Huh. I was reading Dan Bolz this morning in the Washington Post. He said he said a third of the speech was Ukraine. Well, I mean, I thought, you know, that's really kind of picky. I think, you know, if that's your dominant issue, maybe you could even argue that it should have taken up the whole speech. But I thought he had it in perspective. He explained why we should care about Ukraine, and the mood in the chamber. You had a lot of people wearing blue and gold, which is the colors of Ukraine, and the tribute to the Ukrainian ambassador who stood up several times waving her flag. Anything, you know, more than that would have looked like a little bit too nationalistic for another country, it seems to me. I mean, I thought he had the mixture right between foreign and domestic. And you know, typically the State of the Union focuses on domestic policy, and the foreign policy is tucked in at the end. So he reversed it. I mean, Ukraine and the battle for democracy against autocracy. I thought it was really brilliant the way he phrased it and opened the speech with that. And you know, he also showed his various sides of Joe Biden. His frustration came through at some parts. His anger, his determination. I think we saw the man in full more last night. But again, I don't know how many people actually sat in front of a television or computer screen and watched it 102 minutes from start to end. So bits and pieces will be chopped up and delivered over the coming days and weeks. And there are a number of areas where you could, you know, focus in on. I thought the reference to the burn pits in Iraq and Afghanistan and the possible link to cancer, that was a moving moment when the president said that he has some suspicions, which of course can't be proven, that his own son Bo's brain cancer may have been contracted because he served in military in those burn pits. They don't have OSHA regulations in foreign countries to the military, and the military is exempted from any of those regulations. And they just throw all kinds of waste, computer waste, whatever they don't need into pits, and then they pour, you know, jet fuel on it and burn it. And it's John Stewart was on television this morning. He's taken up the cause of people during 9/11 who were exposed to the poisons in the air as a result of the collapse of the towers. And he said 9/11 was the first, was the original burn pit, which was kind of a graphic image. Anyway, there were a lot of serious topics that came up last night, and I thought they were stitched together under this banner of unity. And a lot of these issues, there's no reason why the two parties can't come together on them. And Republicans did cheer in a number of areas on lowering prescription drug costs. They didn't like giving Medicare the right to negotiate separately, right? Because they're, I think, listening to the pharmaceutical companies. The president made the point that there's more that brings us together than keeps us apart, although he said, he kind of smiled and said he did a good job of showing where they disagreed. He talked about immigration, and the Republicans started to chant, build the wall, build the wall. And unless I missed it, the president did not mention the 1-6 insurrection. And I think that's probably, he knew that he might get a very different response from one side of the aisle than the other, and he didn't want to do that. So that's, the trials associated with that are proceeding, and the committee investigating it is also proceeding. But he chose not to mention it, which I thought was an interesting omission.
Eleanor, when we opened up the phone lines this morning for the first hour of the program, we talked about the speech last night, and the two areas that were concentrated on by our listeners, one was exactly what you just brought up, prescription drug cost. The illustration of the $10 in regard to insulin and what people are having to pay for it. Why isn't this a slam dunk issue that the government can fix? That's what the audience says.
Because in the end, the pharmaceutical companies have a hold on Congress, and they give a lot of money for campaign contributions. I think you could get that through, and maybe that is one of the aspects from the Build Back Better bill, which was contained in that, and that could pass as a standalone. So I think there's some possibility on that. It wasn't going to pass as part of the Build Back Better bill because there were too many other programs in that bill that certainly the Republicans didn't like, but Democrats couldn't agree because remember the Build Back Better bill was supposed to be a Democrats only bill. The Republicans opted out of that, but the Democrats weren't able to keep all 50 Democratic senators together in the Senate, and that's where Senators Manchin and Sinema got involved. And so I would put that high on the list as possible to get through. The Republicans, though, you know, this is a political year, and they may not want to give the president that kind of a victory this close to midterms, because the chances look very good at this point that the Republicans could retake the House and even the Senate as well. So they might want to keep that for themselves to push through after they get back in power.
You know, something interesting, and it was the other issue our audience was interested in this morning, and maybe this is not something that is as interesting to the other 49 states, but President Biden did mention Columbus, Ohio last night in the Intel plant.
Yes.
And I'll tell you, it's very interesting because when you talk about the elections, our governor, Mike DeWine, who's a longtime politician, is running for governor again, but in May, he's facing a primary challenge here in Ohio. A sitting governor has not faced a primary challenge in 130 years.
Wow.
And basically, they're hitting him for being too liberal during the pandemic. But what's interesting about this Intel plant, DeWine's ads right now for this primary are all about this Intel plant. And when Biden mentioned that last night, I thought, is that going to hurt DeWine? Because they're going to say, Yeah, look what's going on there. You really are a Democrat. You know, you really are not one of us.
Wow. Why would a party label have anything to do with, you could go there wearing the Working Families Party label or whatever, if you can bring 10,000 jobs to an area that can use those jobs and you can manufacture something that's in huge demand and that will give us a competitive edge against China. Why would it matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican? I mean, I don't get it. The Intel CEO stood up kind of bashfully last night and took a bit of a bow, but I think the numbers were that he, maybe you know better than I, the president said that he has vowed to up his investment in manufacturing to some astronomical figure, which would be the biggest investment in manufacturing ever. So this is quite a coup, and I think DeWine, is he claiming any credit for this, or how is he treating this?
Well, yeah, he's been in all the newspapers with the Intel people and his campaign ads, and he is running them in this primary, so he must have some cause for concern, are all about
right.
The Intel plant.
Right. Well, you know, this is the big question politically. Can, Democrats, and I'm not saying DeWine is a Democrat, but can the economic argument prevail over the cultural argument? And so what DeWine is facing is he's making an economic argument and his critics are running against him in a culture war that, oh, this is a Democratic president who's helped engineer this, so we automatically don't like it, I guess. I mean, that's how I would sort it out. Does DeWine have credible primary opponents?
Well, I tell you, it's interesting. He's got two, I would say, credible. One is Jim Renacci, who has ran for office here in Ohio and held office here in Ohio. And he seems to have the President Trump has not endorsed him, but Brad Pascal, who was President Trump's campaign manager the last time around,
right,
is working for Renacci. And then there's a guy here named Joe Blystone, who he's the really far right guy, but I see more of his signs anywhere than anybody else's.
Does he have Trump's nod? Or
I don't think Trump has endorsed anybody.
Okay.
In this primary, okay. But I think the pandemic really hurt DeWine in this area. And, I mean, the legislature has limited his power on what he can do, and it's a Republican legislature. So this is why this primary is going to be very interesting, because it's a closed primary and that only Republicans can vote in it. And if it were open, I would think DeWine would win, because I think there are some Democrats who support how DeWine handled the pandemic. But if
right.
it's only...
He was responsible, as I recall, with masks and so forth, right? And
mm-hmm. But now a lot of people feel he hurt businesses, he hurt the economy, and that's what Renacci and Blystone are sort of running on.
Mm-hmm. Is there a metric as to how many lives he might have saved? Or
well,
that's kind of hard to measure?
It's hard to measure, but it seems the longer we get in this pandemic that... the vaccinations and the mask mandates are not popular in the Republican Party, and
right.
people only remember recently. I don't think they remember 2 years ago.
Right, and now actually all the mandates are beginning to be lifted. I mean, they've lifted here in the District of Columbia where I live, although many people continue to wear masks in indoor settings.
Yeah,
just in case. Right.
It was, yeah, well, and that was the interesting thing to this whole bit was about a year ago, DeWine lifted the mandates that he had put in place, but the legislature was about 20 days from voting on limiting his power and lifting the mandates anyway.
Okay.
Well. So I think he did not want that to be the story, that the Republican legislature, even though they ended up taking away his power in that, that they actually had to overturn his mandates.
Right.
So it's, I don't
know
how... Does
he have a contentious relationship with them in other ways? Or...
You know, since then, he's tried to be... I don't even know what the word... He's tried to be more lockstep with them since
mm-hmm.
that. I think knowing that an election's coming up, I don't think he's disagreed with them on any other things other
right.
than that. And this
right.
Intel plant is basically radio and television. It's his whole ad at this point.
Right. Well, I think the president, is he going to Ohio today, actually?
I think
or
so.
Or is it? Well, I he's got two trips. One was to Pennsylvania, and I noticed the other was, it was Wisconsin, sorry. It was more of a swing state. Yeah, so Ohio, for some time now, has been considered a Republican state, but you have an interesting Senate race as well. The Democrats have settled on their candidate pretty much. Tim Ryan is kind of a working-class Democrat, and... the Republicans are in a contentious primary, and J.D. Vance certainly getting a lot of attention for his transition from from the hillbilly elegy to Silicon billionaire to down the line Trump supporter. So anyway, Ohio's going to get a lot of attention this campaign season, obviously.
And I think in the end, coming off the State of the Union last night, I think the interesting thing is going to be on primary day, which usually is not a huge turnout in these closed primaries, will more of the people who supported President Trump show up, or will the people who have been Republicans in Ohio for many years who are not necessarily Trump fans show up? I think that's going to prove
right.
to be the case for people like DeWine.
Right, exactly. Well, and the whole with Ukraine and Putin, Trump came out early, kind of declaring Putin a genius, and of course his sort of apparent reverence for Putin and his hardline tactics has been evident for some time. But the president, the former president, has backed off to some extent. And the display on the part of Republicans last night, they were waving Ukrainian flags. And it seems to me the pro-Russia, pro-Putin wing of the Republican Party has been very quiet recently. And this could serve to isolate Trump in some way.
You know, off of that,
maybe wishful thinking on my part.
Well,
I'll admit.
You know, it's very interesting about the President Trump Ukraine comments, Putin comments, because I have had people come up to me in the last week, especially in the last 4 or 5 days, who have the military families who tended to support Trump here in Ohio, who because of this Ukraine situation are not really liking what President Trump has to say, and I think the question is he's not president right now. He doesn't have to say anything. Why do this? Why push this?
Well, I don't want to get into conspiracy theories, but you know, Russian money, oligarchs, whatever ties they may or may not have to the Trump empire. I think there's always been a kind of financial sort of association there. So I think that may be part of it. But I also think, you know, Trump likes the strongman theory of governing. I mean, he fancies himself that way. He's gravitated to, he likes Orbán in Hungary. He has not made any secret of admiring the way, you know, Putin has a hold on his country, and that is all seems to be coming apart now. But I think that in that mold of autocrats, which are not just in this country but emerging around the world, that's where Trump sees himself in that kind of constellation. So it's not surprising that he would look at the way Putin saw what he thought were weaknesses in the NATO alliance and thought that he could move and that NATO would not act and the United States would not act because Ukraine is not an official member of NATO, and he thought he could get away with it. And I think, you know, Trump thought it was very brilliant of him to send what he called peacekeepers into those eastern provinces, the Russian-speaking provinces of Ukraine, and Trump mused that we could use something like that on our southern border. So I think it was like, you know, looking at the chessboard and how Putin was moving the pieces, and I think Trump was admiring of that. But when the bombing starts and the images of all of the desperate women and children and trying to escape, and you now have well over 500,000 refugees flooding into mainly Poland, but elsewhere in Europe. Suddenly, Putin didn't look so smart and savvy. So, former President Trump, has not said anything in the last several days, as far as I know, and that's probably a wise thing on his part, because the world, not only this country, but the world's public opinion, Ukraine has won the information war for sure. I mean, Putin is reviled by everyone around the world, and they're talking about that he is vulnerable to being charged as a war criminal because of the apparent targeting of residential areas, the possible use of cluster bombs, which are illegal. So he's turned himself into a war criminal. So he suddenly doesn't look so smart anymore. And the Russian economy is collapsing. The ruble is worth pennies to the dollar. Stock market, the Russian stock market is closed. The banks can't get any money. They've really been choked off. And when all the talk of sanctions in recent weeks, the analysts were all saying, well, sanctions, you know, money is fungible. Sanctions usually hurt the people who are applying them as opposed to the people they're targeting, and they probably won't work. Well, these are sanctions like nobody's ever seen before. And the fact that the Germans went along and said they would no longer accommodate the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which was a very, which was not yet operational, but was a big money gainer for Russia. And the Germans backed out of that despite their needs for energy, and the Germans are upping their commitment, financial commitment to NATO, and talking about changing their constitution so that they can arm themselves better and send weapons to Ukraine. I mean, the whole face of the world has changed in the last several days, and that face is looking at Putin with horror, and so he must feel pretty alone and isolated, I would think. But then you get into, you got to figure out a way to give him some sort of an off-ramp so he doesn't let this get even more out of hand. I mean, I think that's the balancing act that the West has to play right now.
Eleanor, when we look at the newspapers and we see the images and we've seen all the coverage of the Ukraine incident, and people certainly know the name Ukraine now, if you had to describe this to somebody who doesn't quite understand what happened here, what is going on without all the sanctions and so on and so forth, but what started this, what would you say to them?
Well, I would say it started a long time ago, when the Soviet Union collapsed in the late 80s, early 90s. And the dismantling of the Soviet Empire has been a grievance for Vladimir Putin ever since he entered politics, certainly. He sees the dissolution of the Soviet Empire as the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. NATO is a military alliance that was created in 1949, coming out of World War II. And it expanded under more recent presidents, beginning with Bill Clinton, bringing in the Baltic states and Poland. And then Ukraine declared its independence in 1991, I believe, and they would like to enter NATO, but they share a border with Russia, and the implications of that would really rattle Russia. And Putin has been angling for assurances that Ukraine will never enter NATO for some time. And the truth is, the West has no intention of letting NATO in, but NATO is kind of a bargaining chip between the West and Russia. And Russia is, Putin sees his legacy as restoring the greatness of Mother Russia, and Ukraine is in his sights, and probably the other Baltic republics as well, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia. But he knows there he would have to face NATO. So picking off Ukraine seemed like it would be an easy thing to do, because he ventured into that country in 2014 when Obama and Joe Biden were in the White House, and they didn't take any military action, and the sanctions were not strong, and the feeling was, well, it's a Russian-speaking part of Ukraine, let it stop there. But to let it continue is reminiscent of, and here's a lot more history to put in context, it's reminiscent of 1938 when Germany sought to claim Sudetenland, which was part of Czechoslovakia, because there were German speakers there. And Europe allowed Hitler to get away with that. And in fact, the Europeans at the time even proclaimed the agreement to allow the Germans to take the Sudetenland, sort of guaranteed, quote, peace in our time. And that turned out to be an appeasement that allowed Hitler to continue his rampage. So that's kind of the big historical analogy that people are making now, that you have to stop Putin now, or he will believe that the West will not defend any of the other republics should he move there. And I think he's been totally surprised at how strong NATO has stayed together, because for the last 4 years under Trump, Trump really weakened NATO. And I think Putin was kind of counting on a weakened NATO to allow him to take these steps into Ukraine.
You know, and that becomes an interesting question, Eleanor. The weakening of NATO, and certainly President Trump's complimentary comments about Vladimir Putin. If Putin wanted to do this, wouldn't it have been more advantageous for him to do it 2 years ago?
Well, you can argue that from the right or the left. And the explanation that I think is correct is that Putin has been preparing for this for some time, not just for the last 4 or 5 years, but before that. And he saw the weakening of NATO. He also thought that Trump would get reelected, and that basically he would just walk in once Trump was reelected, I think. And when Biden was elected, he thought, especially after the messy exit from Afghanistan, that Biden was a weak president and that this was the time to move. So that's how I see it. I know that people who supported Trump think that, oh, he had this tough guy image and Putin wouldn't have dared to get away with it. I just don't buy that.
When it comes to this, I mean, we have no idea how it will end, but we support them. Sanctions are in place. They are heavy-duty sanctions. A lot of things are crippling Russia's economy. But can Putin succeed with what he wants to get done here with no boots on the ground, which Biden mentioned last night?
With no boots on the ground by the United States.
Right.
Right, yes. I think, you know, listening to the various ways of how this is going to play out, the Ukrainians have put up a much stiffer defense than anybody expected, but the Russians can still overpower them with more money, more artillery, more people. But the Russian soldiers, they're conscripts, and there are reports in the New York Times of some of them surrendering. They don't want to fight. The Russians and the Ukrainians are culturally common people, and the Russians are looking across at the Ukrainians, and they are seeing mirror images of themselves. They have a lot of family ties across it, so you don't have a will to fight on the Russian side, and I think that's important. I think the tragedy is that people are going to die. Russians are going to go home in body bags. Ukrainians are going to die. Ukrainian civilians are going to be caught in this, plus the refugee chaos that is coming out of this is the biggest refugee crisis, certainly of this century, and maybe bigger than what we've seen in any individual conflict from the last century. So yet Putin is going to be reluctant to just turn tail, right? So he's likely to try to complete the mission from his eyes, which is to the word that's used to decapitate, not literally, but I hope, the government in Kyiv install a puppet government. And then the Ukrainians are not going to stop fighting, and there'll be an insurgency, and the U.S. and NATO will fund that insurgency. So Putin, if he's going to continue, will be facing a weakened economy, an unpopular war. 1 million people have signed a petition against war in Russia. There are thousands of people in the streets. They can't arrest them all. It's not a popular war. So is that what he wants? And so trying to figure out if there's some exit that can accommodate the Ukrainian aspirations and Putin's need for a face-saving exit, I think that's what the West is going to be looking for over the coming days and weeks. The sad thing is that there's probably more bloodshed that's going to happen, but this can't end well for Russia, because he's trying to win a war over a country that is going to be very resistant, and it's going to repeat the experience that the Russians had in Afghanistan, that actually the Americans have had in Afghanistan too. So he's looking at what we call an endless war. He can't win the hearts and minds. I mean, he's already lost that, and he may never ever be able to leave his country for fear of being arrested. And the oligarchs who surround him, who have lots of money parked in this country and in the UK, are going to be watching their fortunes dissipate. So is there going to be some sort of turmoil from within? That may be, you know, wishful thinking on my part as well. But you can't continue to wage an unpopular and a perhaps unwinnable war forever without support. And he doesn't have support from the people, from the public, and he's going to lose support among those around him as well. So why he did this, did he really know the cost that he would have to pay? That's the question. He's been so isolated, and some say, according to reports, really paranoid about COVID, and nobody's been telling him anything he didn't want to hear. That's always a danger for leaders, wherever they are.
When we look at this as far as nuclear warfare and cyber warfare, is there any worry we should have in the United States?
Well, President Biden was asked that question directly about nuclear war, since the Russians have put their nuclear forces on high alert, and he said no. That's it. Blunt, that was it. He didn't engage in conversation. The view of the White House is that this is, you know, desperate talk to try to, you know, scare the West and to try to, justify what he's doing. But realistically, if he were to use nuclear weapon, that would invite retaliation, and then we're off to a World War III that nobody wants to contemplate. I think it's, but you know, for somebody like me, who grew up in the shadow of the Cold War and dove under my desk and duck and cover for years in elementary school, there's always a danger when you're in these hostile situations, and you know, accidents can happen. And you know, is Putin going to be crazy enough that he'll just, okay, let's pull the lever and let's just take everybody, you know, with us? You know, in the final days of the Trump administration, there was concern about what the president might do, and the generals put certain regulations, rules, practices in place to ensure that he couldn't give an order. That was uh, that 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 wasn't vetted by the whole defense machinery. And the same thing happened in the final days of President Nixon. There was a concern about what he might do. So I think it's a threat, but I don't think that the White House or NATO is, you know, adjusting what they're doing in any way with an assumption that this could actually happen. But the fact that Biden chose last night a high-profile speech to state we're not sending troops, and also the administration has been clear that they don't support a no-fly zone because that would potentially put U.S. or NATO forces in position of shooting down a Russian plane, and again, that would escalate the war. So they are getting certain assurances across to Putin that we're not escalating this thing, and you shouldn't either.
Cyber warfare, is that a worry?
Yes, that is a worry. That's very much a worry, and it's. I think that's in its infancy in terms of how to wage it and how to combat it. And it's easier to wage than it is to combat, I think. It's easier to be on the offensive than on the defensive. But hardening all of the potential areas where Russians could attack cyber is, I think, a very active venture right now within the administration, within the Western world. But yes, and they, you know, can do a lot of damage with this. And I think President Biden did say that he gave Putin, when he saw him, a list of 16 sites that if they were cyber attacked, that they would be responded to, you know, with a high level of response. I mean, that would be virtually be considered an act of war. So he's put that on the table, and some critics have said, Biden, really, you shouldn't have detailed that. Well, somebody in the administration who evidently knows what's on the list says, you know, that it's all the key elements of a functioning economy, and you know, it's better to put that out there than to have Putin guessing as to what he might be able to get away with.
Well, the question beckons then, as we've heard for many years now from presidents, from secretaries of state, Putin is not a person who likes to be made to look weak. He doesn't like to back down. As you said, he wants to see Mother Russia restored. That's his goal in life. If these sanctions continue to cripple and public opinion turns against him, could there be a position where he says, what else do I have to lose here, aside from nuclear weapons, aside from cyber attacks, what else could they do?
What else could they do behind, well, the cyber attacks, I think is the answer, and to double down in Ukraine. I mean, what they did when they put down the war in Chechnya, which a breakaway Chechnya republic, and they carpet bombed, they destroyed everything. He could do that. It could be like, you know, London during the Blitzkrieg. I mean, I think that's the fear of what could happen next.
Is there any way Putin can get out of this at this point, saving face for himself?
I suppose if he could keep the provinces that he claims should be his, that would be more than Crimea. Right now, Ukraine is refusing to give any ground on that, but conceivably they could make that into between North Korea and South Korea, it's a demilitarized zone. Maybe they could make that a demilitarized zone or something, so that he feels like he gets something. I'm not an expert on this, but I I can't think of anything else that they can't give them any more of Ukraine, that's for sure. I mean, that the red line has been drawn. But conceivably, those provinces and Ukraine would not like that either. They're fighting to preserve the integrity of their country. So, but at some point, they could be taking, too many civilian losses. So it becomes what the trade-off is if you can save lives. I think Ukraine is not at that point yet, and Russia, I think, still thinks they can win this. But as it grinds on, the calculus could change on both sides.
Eleanor, what doesn't the common person, with the State of the Union last night and the state of affairs around the world and the state of this country domestically, what doesn't the common person know right now who doesn't read the papers every day? What's going on behind the scenes in Washington?
Well, with the midterms coming up in November, the Democrats are bracing for major losses if they can't turn around the overall impression of the Biden presidency and can't convince the American people that in the last year things have actually gotten better in terms of getting past COVID, in terms of an economy where you have millions of people leaving their jobs to find better jobs. You have an economy that's actually booming, and that you have the Western world is united, and that you have the potential of legislation that would, as your listeners care about, that would lower prescription drugs, and also on COVID, that they're working on drugs that you can go, as the president said, you go to the drugstore and get a positive COVID test and get the pills right there on the spot at no cost. So I think the administration is trying to let people know they're not just concerned with the big issues, they're concerned with kitchen table issues, prescription drug costs, the rising inflation, and that the time not to change, horses in the middle of crossing the stream, to use an old analogy, that if you leave the Democrats in charge of Congress after November, you might actually get some legislation that that helps your pocketbook in terms of child care and health care and education costs. So he's trying to personalize his presidency. And I think he did a good job last night, but whether that can be sustained over the next several months is in a society as fractured as this one and as busy as people's lives are, is another question. There's a lot of sort of selling and marketing and messaging that both sides are going to be doing, and we'll see which side wins come November.
Eleanor Clift, one of the best. Eleanor, thank you so much for joining us. It's good to talk with you again.
Same here. Thanks so much.
Bye. Eleanor Clift fills you in on everything you want to know. We're going to take a break. Come back in about 15 minutes with Glenn Kobel.
Friday mornings at 11:15. It is replayed Wednesday at 3 o'clock and also Sunday morning at 8 o'clock. Also,